Hello, welcome back to MIR Meets. I'm Kai Samuel Shablovsky, and today I'm speaking with Shachi Curl, the president of the Angus Reid Institute. Shachi, welcome.
Hi, Kai. Thanks for having me.
First of all, Shachi, could you just describe the Angus Reid Institute and what you guys do?
Sure. So the Angus Reid Institute occupies a really unique space in the Canadian polling and public policy world in that we do things that commercial pollsters don't do. We make all of our data available for free online to anybody, no paywalls or anything like that. And we self-commission the vast majority of the work we do. We do have some partners that we work with, but those partners are not sort of paying for data. They are allowed to make a contribution to a project, but they're never allowed to pay more than half of that of the cost of that project. And why do we do those things? Why do we set up our work in that way? The Institute was founded back in 2014. Like, time really flies.
Okay.
And at that point in particular, and you can make the case it's not tremendously different now, there was a real lack of availability of independent polling data that students, journalists, politicians, policymakers, interested people could access. So either it was data that had been paid for by an entity and therefore they own the data, they're cherry picking what gets released into the public discourse. The world in which media sources would commission polling and then put the polling information out to their readers or their subscribers or audiences. I mean, we both know what's happening with traditional media newsrooms at the moment, so that's not really happening anymore. And instead, what was happening were newsrooms were sort of taking anything they could get their hands on without a lot of questions around the methodology or the rigor or the independence of that data. Governments used to be, believe it or not, before either of us were born, in the habit of commissioning polling, which again, they would release the data around when they wrote white papers and were very happy to be transparent about releasing opinion data about jammy policy issues and sort of hash it out and sort of do the internal debate via the white paper process. That became politically very inconvenient to politicians. So their answer, depending on who's in power, was to shut a lot of that work down. And again, you look at what government now commissions in terms of polling work, how much of that do we actually see released into the atmosphere, so to speak? So we felt like it was important for there to be a space and a place for people to be able to access and consume and understand in a very digestible way where people are in the country on any manner of issues that isn't coming from a place where a client has paid for this or there's a big agenda push or an advocacy push around it. It's like, this is what it is, and y'all can make your own conclusions about where we're at based on this data.
So, could you talk a bit about the current state of polling, how things have changed? Obviously people answer their phones way less now. I saw that you guys do online surveys.
Yes.
Yeah.
So methodology absolutely is 100% the biggest change over the last 50, 60, 70 years. I mean, I don't know how much people know or realize that Gallup, for example, one of the oldest polling companies in North America, I think, if not the oldest, they sent their interviewers door to door doing in-person interviews. And you'd literally be a Gallup researcher or interviewer, knock on the door, talk to, this was the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, like talk to a housewife, like she pours the sanka, you go through a written interview set, and think about all of the problems with methodology on that. So you're only sort of canvassing for these interviews in what you deem to be safe neighborhoods. So think like white middle class or above neighborhoods. You are getting, therefore, a very limited perspective on what people think. Also, if you want to do polling on issues that are more divisive or more personal, think about health or sex or spending or any of those things. Is that nice lady who's pouring the Sanka really going to tell you something that she feels socially awkward or talking about? Or even if there's a real answer, is that a socially acceptable answer? So, the polling has gone from that to a number of different methodologies that are aimed at inclusivity, making sure you're getting as access to as many voices as possible, and also randomness. And I say randomness because there is no such thing as a truly, truly random sample anymore. So, pollsters graduated from in-person interviews and then the advent of the telephone. And then for a while, there was this golden age through the 70s and into, most of the 80s, really into the early 90s, where receiving a phone call, first of all, the phone rings, you don't know who it is. People pick up the phone and they want to talk to you. And so think of like the 70s, the Farrah Fawcett era of polling, where people like, the response rates were very, very high, and you could control a level of randomness because of the notion of a 7-digit phone number. So you can randomly dial. You don't know who's on the other end. They don't know it's some pesky pollster wanting to ask questions, and people are willing to talk. That changes over time. Female participation in the workforce that really starts to tick up in the mid-70s, early 80s, and really goes on a tear means fewer people are home during the day to answer those questions. So now you're calling it dinner time or in the evening. Well, that's when you're trying to have dinner with your kids. You don't want to be talking to a pollster. Call display pops up. Well, it's not grandma, it's a pollster. So then you start to see more refusal and more refusal and more refusal to the point where phone polling, and now, of course, mobile phones, phone polling now has a massive refusal rate. For every 10 phone calls you make, plan on 8 to 9 of those calls being refused, i.e., person doesn't pick up and they say, no, I don't want to talk to you. So are you really getting a random sample that way now? So this has been around for a while too. The way we poll is online using online panels that are comprised of tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people. They empanel themselves, and all they're doing as potential respondents are signing up to say, here's who I am demographically, right? Here's where I live, here's my age, here's a few things about me that I'm comfortable sharing. And I am sort of pre-screening myself to receive a survey. It doesn't mean that they get to pick and choose the surveys they're going to receive. And in fact, I get tons of emails all the time saying, how come nobody asked me about this one? Well, that is called randomness or randomization. So we can't say that it is truly 100,000% random. That doesn't exist in any platform anymore. But you can still have a randomized way where you're pulling a sample of 1 or 2% of that huge panel in, and they don't call the shots around whether they receive that survey. They can choose not to do the survey, but we have far higher response rates, exponentially higher than they do by phone. So that's now the next generation that everyone's trying to figure out how to do well and scientifically, and not just for market research, but also for a policy and opinion research, is where do chatbots fit into all of this? Where does AI fit into this? How does mobile-enabled or text-based polling fit into this in ways that people will want to participate and not feel weird about it? So that is the current iteration and generation of where we're at and where we're trying to go.
That's really interesting. I want to ask you about a few polls that Angus Reid has done and some things that have jumped out at me. The first thing that I noticed was how low the approval ratings are for so many provincial leaders right now across the country, especially in Ontario and Quebec. Doug Ford had 34%, Legault had 25%, and then he just resigned. So we saw the immediate impact of that recently. Healthcare and cost of living receive particularly low scores, especially in Ontario and Quebec. I'm wondering what you think, like how you interpret this data. 25% just seems so low to me, or 34%. And yet these are premiers who've been in power for quite a bit of time. It seems like my observation of the trend in provincial politics is kind of that a lot of these premiers are very unpopular, and yet they keep getting reelected, and there's a general kind of like apathy around provincial politics. So I'm wondering what you've seen.
Provincial politics, I would say there's a couple of different factors here. Approval and vote are not always parallel measures and are frequently not parallel measures. If you have a leader, a politician of any level, federal, provincial, local, any stripe that is very popular, as long as they are able to carry along their party, that can sometimes be a predictor of vote intention, but in many cases, and in a lot of the cases you just pointed out, that's not what happens. You can have leaders that are running ahead of their party, i.e., they're more popular than their party. We're seeing that, for example, with Prime Minister Mark Carney at the moment. Per our polling, his approval level is at about 60%, but his party is sort of, low 40s. So, he's not running as his party's not running well behind him, so to speak. You see the opposite effect with opposition leader Pierre Poilievre. He is personally quite unpopular with many, many people in this country, but his party still does really quite competitively with the Liberals. So he's running, as we would say, behind his party. Now you're bringing those premiers into the mix. There's a couple of different factors here. First of all, one of them is longevity or familiarity, sorry, can breed contempt. So the longer you're around, your honeymoon period is over. People know what you are. They probably don't like you very much, in the case of Mr. Legault and in Mr. Ford's case. But, any election is not a ballot where a voter is like, do you want Rob Ford or not? Sorry, Rob Ford. I said Ford. Rob Ford, his dear departed brother. Do you want Doug Ford or do you not want Doug Ford? It's do you want Doug Ford or do you want this leader or do you want that leader? And so that is, it's not always translatable to vote. You can have a personally unpopular premier, but voters are making their decisions based on the available alternatives. And if they don't see the available alternatives as any better, they're going to choose that leader over and over again, even if those people don't warm the cockles of their heart. So again, longevity, end of a honeymoon period, and also knowing that you can sort of have not great feelings towards leader, maybe dump on the leader a little bit, on the premier, on the prime minister, whomever it is. But also, you may go back to that person because even if you don't love the job they're doing, you're not, that's not, in many cases, it's not going to drive you to the other side of the ideological street and vote for a party with whom your political values don't align. So that's where you tend to see those dichotomies between lack of popularity but continued political success.
Right. That makes sense. Another thing that I noticed was that immigration and crime grew as important issues in the 2025 election, especially among conservative voters. How do you interpret that?
So there is always kind of an organic aspect to what people feel about issues, but there's also often a strong response to how leaders are framing issues. So go back to that campaign and the run-up to that campaign. The conservatives have run quite successfully on crime and public safety issues. So they talk about it a lot. They say, look, streets are not as safe as they used to be, neighborhoods are not as safe as they used to be. Policies aimed at public safety, such as bail reform, have not been enacted, making streets less safe. You can agree with that or disagree with that, but it was a significant part of the conservatives' platform and campaign rhetoric. And so the more a leader talks about this, the more the people that follow that leader are going to say, yes, this is an issue. And now it's planted in their consciousness. So they're now noticing it more because we're talking about it more. So that's part of it. The other issue, particularly with crime, is it's not really ideological. And what I mean about that is you can be left-leaning or right-leaning. You can believe in a big social safety net or small government. But if you don't feel safe in your neighborhood or in your community, that is going to be reflected in how you think and how you feel. And that's where crime particularly became much more of a focused issue in the last election. You also see, for example, how certain policies at both the federal and the provincial level around things like decriminalization of hard drug possession came into the mix. And we talked about bail reform or bail a policy as well. So a lot of that really came and packaged itself up quite nicely with a little ribbon in that election. Immigration, another issue where it transcended ideology, and at the same time was something that the opposition was very focused on, and additionally was something that people were noticing more. It was more visible to
Yeah,
them.
that's what
And
when you were saying that that it seemed like people were caring more about immigration or ranking immigration higher on surveys in terms of their most important issues. Are you correlating that directly with the rhetoric of Poilievre and the Conservative Party, or do you think that that has more to do with what people are seeing in their daily lives? Because I
I
think
think I'm trying
it
to
must
say
be
that it's
both, right?
both. I'm trying to say that it's both because it's iterative. Politicians pick up on stuff that people are telling them about and then they run with the ball. And then the more they run that ball, the more people are paying attention to them running that ball and going, "Oh, hey, look at that." And so it's a combination, but the anecdotal evidence or the anecdotal sort of reporting around how immigration, particularly as it ramped up very quickly in a short period of time post-pandemic, were creating or were said to be creating situations where rent was going up in Canadian cities, access to healthcare was deteriorating, or other comments and other feelings that Canadians were having at the time. Definitely would have informed what politicians started talking about. MPs are on the doorstep all the time. What do you care about? What's going on in your neighborhood? And there was certainly a sense among Canadians that it was too much, too quickly, and not necessarily matched to the skills or the needs that our communities had in terms of just filling labor gaps. And so all of that has led us to where we are. And again, I would say it's not particularly ideological. You can be right of center, you can be left of center, but if you feel like there's too many people, and that's why my kid can't get a job or why my kid can't move out into an apartment or why I can't get access to a family doctor. These are some of the things that we were hearing. Again, I'm not endorsing those points of view. I'm saying that was what was out there. It will have an impact on public opinion.
Yeah, I think also in the 2025 election that we just saw, the role of the US was obviously huge. Donald Trump interfering in, sort of inserting himself into the election.
He was the main character. He was calling, depending on your literary lens, it was either the protagonist or the villain, but he was the main character of the 2025 election campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. And I feel like that was a really interesting political moment. And I was wondering how it affected national pride, because Angus Reid has been looking at national pride for a while. And I noticed that there was a decline in the last decade, a pretty marked decline, especially among younger people. And so do you think that that decline has reversed at all since then?
Oh, we're seeing it happening in real time. And what I'll say is there's nothing like a crisis to pull people together and to kind of shake them into realizing what else might be important. And so, yes, even though Canada economically had been, Canadians who were feeling economically upwardly mobile and sort of having a good life weren't necessarily feeling that deep emotional sense of pride or attachment to their country. Well, there's nothing like a US president saying, I'm going to make you the 51st state and you suck and you're not our best friend, for people to be like, well, hey, wait a minute, you can't talk to us like that. And for them to then turn inward and take a pause and think about, yeah, what do we have here and do we value it? So I saw that during the pandemic, particularly in its first weeks. And it is crazy to me that we're in February of 2026. That was almost 6 years ago. That is bananas to me. But nonetheless, it was a time of such deep anxiety, uncertainty, and crisis that Canadians pulled together. There was a deep sense of we're all in this together. It was a time when stay-at-home policies, masking policies, vaccination policies became, as the crisis deepened, very popular. Sort of pro-social conformative policies were things that were very popular for a while because of that sense of crisis. It was also a time when politicians were very popular because the politicians were able to lean on crisis leadership, which is trust me, listen to me, do what I'm telling you, and I promise you we'll get through this together. There, from a political standpoint, there's not a lot you can argue with there. It's like, no, you're wrong, you're a booby head. Like, no, it's not a policy debate. It's stay home so we don't all have mass casualties. It's a very different lens of leadership. And then you saw that as well, quite significantly in the last election, and even now, sort of basically every time Trump opens his mouth around this stuff, where Canadians are looking to their elected leaders to really, because Canadians themselves, when we ask them, how should we react to this? Should we take a soft line and try to appease Trump and try to make it better? Or should we take a very hard line and to hell with whatever we suffer economically, we should take a super hard line? Canadians are still indicating a year plus into this crisis that they want to see their leaders take a hard line. So not to capitulate on tariff stuff and not to capitulate on other aspects of this. As a result, when leaders say, hey, we are going to stand our ground, so to speak, that is a popular line. And what it does is it provides cover around other things. So if you've got a crisis in your auto sector, it's Trump's fault. If you've got a crisis in the forestry sector, it's Trump's fault. Even if it was a crisis before Trump started saying any of this, it's Trump's fault now. But I'll tell you something else. The more these crises become normalized, which happens the longer they last, the more that halo effect on the politicians themselves subsides.
Do you have a sense it's subsiding already, or it's still fresh?
I feel like it's very situational and episodic. So it was starting to subside until sort of the beginning of the year and last fall when the crisis all sort of kicked off again, and then Greenland was back in the mix and all of these other things started happening and it feeling very personal all over again. Through periods of quiet, other issues such as cost of living, access to primary health care come to the forefront. And incumbent politicians are viewed through a more cynical, more jaded eye. But when you have these crises, people kind of snatch back together.
And do you have a sense for national pride specifically, if there were particular demographics that were more or less receptive or reactive to the 51st state threats?
I mean, it's a political demographic. If you are a segment of conservative voter, and this is where it's really important to understand majorities versus segments, almost every pro-Trump, let's join the United States person is a conservative voter at home in Canada, but not every conservative voter, and indeed the majority of conservative voters absolutely detest Trump and have no interest in being the 51st state. But there is an influential segment of that conservative base who have a different point of view than the rest of the country, and indeed than the rest of their fellow conservative voters. And that actually represents a real challenge for the conservative leader to try and walk that tightrope between not alienating that part of the base, because he needs to get elected at the end of the day, but at the same time, not making himself so toxic to anybody who looks at Trump and says, what are you doing?
And how has Canadians' view of the United States changed over all of this?
I mean, we have seen views of the United States hit all-time lows, or at least 50-year lows, as far back as I could find data for. Through many times we've seen opinions of the US administration through the according to Canadians or the country itself, kind of ebb and flow, go up and down. Often if there's an unpopular Republican in the White House, Canadians who tend to overall lean more left than right. They don't they you know they tend to have a more jaded view through those periods of the United States. But I've never seen anything like this. And when you add into that mix, it's not just, oh, we disapprove or we have an unfavorable or negative view of the United States, but that extends to we are not going to spend our money there. We don't feel welcome there. We will not vacation there. We do not think that we should be pursuing economic partnerships there. Then it really starts to, become, it's not just the talk, it's also Canadians walking their talk. And we've seen that too over a sustained period of time where the I'm not going to vacation in the States, I'm going to cancel my trip to Vegas, I will not winter in Florida, that wasn't a momentary blip. It's been continuing for a long time now.
And it's obviously difficult to predict the future, but do you think that this will outlive Trump, or do you think this is really a temporary phenomenon?
Yeah, I'm not a fortune teller. I mean, it does feel like something has been more fundamentally damaged this time around than at other periods of time. And we Canadians and Americans went through some stuff after 9/11 and during the Iraq War. They've gone through some moments of estrangement, but this feels a lot more serious. But I can't speak to how much resilience is in that relationship, or where can what how long it will take Canadians to sort of warm up again, if at all, right? So, I mean, I imagine they will if this ever ends, but also who's to say that it will end? So, yeah, I don't do fortune telling.
Yeah, I saw Mark Carney's speech at Davos, which is obviously quite famous by now, and how he spoke about a rupture essentially in the international order, and we saw the big budget that they released and investment in infrastructure and all of that, but I think sort of coming back to the idea of national pride and like where we situate ourselves as Canadians, I think. It's interesting. I think it's going to be interesting to see how we respond to this over the next few years and how we might change our perspective of like where we are in the world, as our southern neighbor becomes more and more unreliable.
I mean, if
Whether
anything,
there's
this has shaken us, right? It's shaken us as a country. I was there 8 years ago when, under Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Canada was very much like, yes, we're going to find other trade partners. We're going to form other strategic alliances. We're going to make new friends. And actually, they don't need to be friends. They just need to be people we can do business with. And all of the talk was there, and nothing happened. And I think, again, it remains to be seen the extent to which Canada is able to translate the talk and the pursuit of other economic alliances and partnerships into something more long-lasting or indelible, or whether, if this crisis passes, then Canadians default back to what's easy.
And that's essentially because we're so economically integrated with the US.
True, but it's also because for 30 plus years there was not much impetus, incentive, or desire to economically integrate with other countries. You default to what's easy.
And that's what's really interesting about Mark Carney's speech is he's saying it's not a break. This isn't a blip. This is a rupture. So if he really believes that, then that does imply that more long-term
Well,
concrete
he's
action.
one person, right? So okay, how does that then shake down into international economic integration? How does that relate to provincial economic integration, whether it's interprovincial, we're still waiting for all those barriers to drop, those interprovincial trade barriers, or provincial integration with overseas markets? I talked to diplomats in this country, and my they talk about trying to engage provincial governments to say, hey, invest here in country X or country Y. And where there is a willingness, what doesn't exist is an infrastructure. So, those things are going to take time to build out.
I thought one really interesting proposal that I was seeing in a few places was a national service program in Canada for young people. And I think personally, I think it's a great idea, actually. I think it has the power or the ability, if done right, to really offer some promise to young people if something is offered in return, like for university or something like that. Like, I think young people are really many people are looking for support and structure, and I think it could provide that. And I saw that you guys did a survey on that.
Well, I did a survey on that because I was interested in it, because one of the things that we're talking about, is like, well, how do you recruit into the armed forces? How do you actually build out Canada's defense capacity if people don't want to join? At the same time, when I did that survey last year, we were looking at sky-high youth unemployment. And also, I think one of the things that's really changed is, because Canadian society is drawn upon from so many immigrants coming from different parts of the world, their kids are often exposed to other countries where national service is baked into the fabric of those societies. So whether it's Korea or Greece or Israel or many other countries, you might have a cousin that did national service. Your parents might have done national service. And so whereas I think a lot of people looked very derisively at that kind of notion even, 5 or 10 years ago, and I also really looked at it from the perspective of how much do young people in this country, or frankly, people of any age in this country, really understand people from other parts of the country. So how many people, who grew up in British Columbia know, understand, the life of a young person in northern Saskatchewan, and vice versa? So it was sort of through that lens that I asked those questions about mandatory national service, and like looking at how much young people sort of embrace that idea, less embracing of the militaristic aspect of it. So a lot of people did say, yes, that should be defense related, but a lot of other people said, well, we would support if it was service related. So maybe it's going to plant trees or volunteering in a medical or a first response kind of way area of work, or maybe it's something else. And I think that idea of going and doing something that's beyond and outside yourself, as societally young people, I think have collapsed. And hey, young people are always focused on young people. Even before phones, I'm not crap. Like even the boomers were all like, "Oh, kids today." It's like, yeah, well, you guys started it. You were the ultimate teenagers who were all about yourselves. But I do think that at a time when, we're literally just drawn into our phones and the doom scrolling and the social media, like they're not just catchphrases. This is how people live now. The idea of doing something beyond yourself, I think, really resonated for those young people who pronounced and showed support for some of those ideas around national service.
Absolutely. I think it could be an opportunity to build real skills and also meet people, like you were saying, from across the country. Living in Quebec, I really see, I grew up in Toronto and I live in Montreal. I go to school there and I see a huge difference between people from Montreal and Toronto. And when I ask a lot of friends that I know from Montreal or from Quebec, do you feel more Quebecois or more Canadian? A lot of times they'll say more Quebecois because I don't even know what it means to be Canadian. And I think if that's something that a lot of young people are saying, even in just in one region of the country, if we're really, yeah, like it all kind of depends on how real this fear is, right? Like, is the country, the massive superpower to our south, really an existential threat? Is that a political point, or is that the truth? Because I think if that's the truth, it requires more concrete action.
Well, what I'll say to that is the fact that we're even asking that question, the fact that you're even asking that question, like, is this an existential threat? Just goes to show how serious the situation has become.
For sure.
Because I cannot imagine, even 2 years ago, when Trump was initially starting to say this, and we're like, aha, that's just Trump being Trump. He's just trolling us. And it's also combined with the fact that post-Dominion, so since 1867, there has not been a real or rhetorical threat to Canadian sovereignty ever. And when you think about how unique that is relative to all these other countries in the world, think about what that's like relative to Europe post-World War, First World War and Second World War, South America, Africa, the Middle East, Asia, all of these countries in all these parts of the world that have had their sovereignty like actually violated. For us, we've been existing in this very safe bubble for all these years. Even the talk of it is incredibly rattling.
Chachi Curl, thank you for your time.
I really enjoyed the time and congratulations with this podcast, and I look forward to more episodes.
Thanks a lot.